The following podcast contains mature language and discussions that are not suitable for younger audiences. The opinions voiced in this podcast are our own. We are not experts on the topic we present, but have conducted our own research. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to the Strange and Undecided podcast. I'm your host, Jarrett, joined by my co-host,
Patrick. We have a very special episode for you today. Just kidding. I don't know what we're talking about, but every episode we do only gets better and better. You research the topics, so I have faith in you.
So have you ever heard of a place called Kamloops, British Columbia?
That I actually have heard of.
Okay. So not too far away from Kamloops, very close to it, is a place called Tronquil. And it is home to the Tronquil Sanatorium.
Why does it sound French?
It is French. We'll get into the actual specifics of the name when I do the background, but it is derived from French people. So this week's episode is going to be a little different, rooted more in history, but with some interesting speculation along the way. We are going to explore the mysterious and haunted walls of Tronquil Sanatorium.
You guys didn't see that, but Jared did a little accent with his hand there when he said Tronquil.
I'm trying my best.
Give him credit for that one.
Opening in 1907 and closing in 1991, it has changed faces many times from a hospital for treating tuberculosis to a hospital for people with mental illness. Since it has been closed down, some people believe it to be haunted by the ghosts of people who passed away at the hospital. Dating back almost 5,000 years, Sequapemec communities, I apologize if I said that wrong, formed to Kemloops, known now as Kamloops, which translates to the meeting of rivers. This would be the Tronquil River and the Thompson River, which feeds into Kamloops Lake. Archaeological finds from the Tronquil area suggest that the Sequapemec were complex and quite innovative at the time, with many village sites uncovered.
That's just a native population there?
Yes. The modern name of the area came about from Francophone fur traders nicknaming Chief Picwemu Tronquil for his tranquil nature.
Ah, I like that.
The First Nations people would thrive in this area until Europeans colonized North America in the 1800s. They ended up being confined to a small portion of their original land and were pushed out of their traditional territory. The Europeans brought disease with them, in particular, tuberculosis, which spread like wildfire through many communities in 1850, and the rate of infection was high among the First Nations people. Tuberculosis, for those of you who don't know, is also referred to as the White Plague, consumption, or simply TB. It is an infectious disease commonly affecting the lungs, but it can affect anywhere in the body. It is caused by a bacterium called Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Symptoms of tuberculosis often include a bad cough, chest pain, weakness, weight loss, lack of appetite, and a fever. It is not easy to contract tuberculosis. However, it can spread through the air as well as bodily fluids from sneezing, coughing, or contact with saliva.
Also, it's very important when you have tuberculosis, make sure you use a cough rag so you can fit the description of like an old-timey tuberculosis patient. You know like how you see them in TV, just like coughing blood into rags? That's what I picture right here.
Yeah, that's pretty much how these people lived, and it's pretty sad. If left untreated, the result can be death.
I think we should go back to that, by the way. Cough rags?
Oh, nowadays? 100%. At the time in 1867, the leading cause of death for people in Canada was tuberculosis, as there was no cure. By the 1900s, it was estimated that 1 out of every 7 people died from tuberculosis on a global scale. However, these estimates were based solely on white people. In 1935, First Nation peoples made up only 3.7% of the provincial population. 32% of deaths from tuberculosis were in the First Nation population. Nowadays, it is a well-known fact that First Nations communities were disproportionately affected by tuberculosis compared to the general population.
Why is that?
My guess is that they've never been exposed to any diseases like that before. And when Europeans came over, they had dealt with disease in Europe from before, so they had better immunity to it. Whereas when they brought it into North America, these people had never been exposed. Their immune systems were not developed enough. It's kind of like an immunocompromised person versus a healthy person.
I can imagine also their community would have been more close, tight-knit, like living in close quarters to each other.
100%. They had huts and tents and stuff like that in the area, and they were all about community and being close together. So yeah.
Like long huts, you fit like 40 people in there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a breeding ground for infection.
Oh, absolutely. Medical professionals at the time didn't know how to cure the disease, but they certainly tried to find different ways. Average people with no medical background were even eager to help. During the 1890s, two families, the Fortunes and the Cooneys, allowed people infected with tuberculosis to live on their property in small cabins or tents to try and recover their health. Each family owned a large ranch so they could accommodate a great number of people. In my research, I wasn't able to actually find the exact number of people that stayed here, but it was a fairly significant amount.
So these were just wealthy families looking to help the community type of thing?
Pretty much. They just owned ranches, a ton of property, and they knew people had tuberculosis. And at the time, just resting and trying to get better was the only solution.
Love to see it.
In January of 1904, the British Columbia Society for the Prevention and Treatment of Consumption and Other Forms of Tuberculosis gathered to discuss and set in motion a plan for treating tuberculosis, and this was to build a specific hospital for them. It would have a condition of being isolated, however. The group found properties that were for sale that fit the conditions required for a successful hospital. They had a fundraiser to raise money, and eventually they accumulated enough. The Fortune property that was previously mentioned was purchased for $58,000, which included 600 acres. On a different property, they ended up taking over a lease from the Dominion government that included 2,000 acres. Expansion occurred at a later date in 1922, where 700 acres was eventually purchased from the Cooney family, which I also mentioned previously.
I can imagine just the views, because they're probably remote in the middle of nowhere. Probably got some mountains in the background. I mean, if you got TB, that's the place where you want to be.
Yeah, the views from this place were quite amazing, if you can call it that, respectfully. But there's tons of pictures actually online. I'll be posting them in the show notes, but this place was very heavily documented throughout the years. And just the kind of scenic backdrops of everything and the isolation of the area, it's quite peaceful.
For context, we live in Ontario. Our backdrop is just like concrete and not too nice.
No.
Oh, we want some mountains here too.
On November 28th of 1907, the Tuberculosis Hospital was officially opened and it was named the King Edward Memorial Sanatorium. Initially, patients were kept in the buildings originally made on the property, but as time went on, the demand for more space grew. The grounds were under an almost perpetual state of construction. 3 years after opening, the hospital accommodated 49 patients. Working in the hospital were four nurses, assisted by 12 attendants. The hospital grew to accommodate 360 patients. Eventually, the older buildings were replaced as the years went on. The rate of construction was a direct result of the number of patients flowing into the hospital. After World War I, many soldiers returned with the disease and sought treatment. It's a horrible situation, really. You fight for your country and survive the horrors of war, like gunfire, bayonet charges, mustard gas, and shelling by bombs, just to make it home, contract this disease, and potentially die from it. With a growing amount of people coming to the hospital, they needed to find out a way to get healthy food to the patients. Reasons as to why this was, I will discuss in the next little bit. On the property, there was a place called Alexandra Ranch. This was used to grow crops for food as well as raise animals for the hospital, patients, and staff. They were even able to sell to the public. It was so successful that the hospital was actually making a profit. Overcrowding as well as urbanization were considered the main factors that contributed to people contracting and spreading tuberculosis. To counter this, sanatoriums were situated in isolated areas to prevent the spread to bigger populations and for patients to get fresh air. There was no known cure at the time for tuberculosis. However, the hospital's focus was on educating people and teaching them how to not spread infection, as well as how they could take care of themselves. This consisted of plenty of rest, healthy food, and fresh air. This was believed to be the best treatment for tuberculosis. Patients at the sanatorium were set up on open-air verandas. Basically, there were beds outside on balcony-like areas that were exposed to the weather to ensure patients got fresh air. However, this was not changed during the colder Canadian months, and some nurses who took care of patients on these verandas observed their faces were covered in frost on cold winter mornings.
Jesus, did they just forget about them when it was frosty out?
That's what it sounds like to me, is that they just kind of left them out there, but I don't think they knew what else to do. They didn't want to bring them inside. It was all part of the strict plan for them to get better, and they had to get their fresh air, and I guess they really didn't care about what the weather was doing.
I can imagine healthcare back then being sort of similar to today's, with too many patients, not enough staff, and then things just happen like that. It's like an oopsie, should have hired more staff.
Admittance to the sanatorium wasn't free. Approximately 50% of patients at the hospital had to pay for their stay and their restoration. It would cost a person about $55 a month back then, and the average length of time for treatment was about 200 days. The thing that made the Tronquil Sanatorium unique was the formation of a whole village known as Tronquil, which was built around the property. The village of Tronquil possessed regular features such as a fire department as well as basic stores. However, for obvious reasons, the townspeople stayed away from the hospital as they knew it was in their best interest to stay away from people with tuberculosis.
That education goes a long way.
It does. See, I feel like we've, in terms of modern medicine, we typically just treat whatever the ailment is. We don't educate people initially on how to prevent. Or if we do, people just don't care for the most part.
Free healthcare, we don't care.
Yeah, exactly. It's if I get sick, somebody go fix it for me. So it's kind of more of like a mentality.
What do you think? Should we go back to the paying for your own hospital bills here in Canada?
No, that's okay. I'll just move to the States if I want to. The hospital continued to operate through the years. However, in the late 1940s, anti-tuberculosis drugs entered the world. Drug companies ended up synthesizing an antibiotic that could effectively treat tuberculosis. Because of this, the need for tuberculosis hospitals began to dwindle. The Tronquil Sanatorium had housed more than 600 patients and staff. However, with the introduction of the tuberculosis medication, the rate of new cases had significantly decreased. By 1958, Tronquil Sanatorium was shut down and the remaining patients were transferred to a facility in Vancouver.
Where does the word sanatorium come from? I always assumed that meant to do with the mind.
So the word sanatorium originates from Latin and it means well, healthy, or sane.
So a healthatorium, per se.
Correct. This was not the end of Tronquil. In July 1959, the province opened the doors of Tronquil Sanatorium once again, but instead of treating tuberculosis patients, it was set up as an institution for people with mental illness.
That sounds more like what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, so the conversion of treating a infection to treating people suffering from a mental health disorder of some sort.
You got to go somewhere. At least they were trying to help.
That's the troubling part. So a lot of the research that I did, they used words that I'm not going to repeat here. But again, it was a very different time and certain words that were used. The terminology has changed greatly since then.
I can imagine this building too being repurposed as a place for mental health.
There was overcrowding at other mental health facilities such as Essendale, also called Riverview Hospital in Coquitlam, and Woodlands in New Westminster. And they needed to transfer patients somewhere else.
Would you rather have a view of the Woodlands or the Riverview?
I'd go for a Riverview, personally.
Agreed.
However, it has been reported that there were poor treatment of patients and unacceptable living conditions at Tronquil. According to various newspaper articles, the Tronquil Institution treated patients better compared to other institutions in BC. We might have to revisit some of these places in future episodes.
So let us know if this is a topic that was interesting to you today, and we'll cover more places like this.
Despite this report, patient rights were believed to be taken away for people at Tronquil. Patients were not allowed to open their own mail, which included any packages sent by family. If visitors came and gave them food, clothes, money, matches, or other items, they were not allowed to give them directly to the patient, and they had to be checked thoroughly. They were forced to do unpaid work on the farm, which was a gross injustice. However, at the time, this was explained away as being an effective treatment and therapeutic for the patient. All in all, this enhanced the mystery of the area. A decision was made years later, leading into 1983, that the institution would be shut down and it would become obsolete. Many of the staff called this place home and were devastated by the news. On July 19, 1983, 40 employees of the 650 total staff protested the closure and occupied the buildings for 3 weeks. And during that time, people continued to flow in and join them. There were still 324 patients at the institution. However, they ended up being transferred to different places such as community care, family homes, or other institutions. According to an article that I found, 55 patients were not ready to return to the general population and were instead sent to Glendale. Glendale was known for having terrible conditions.
I mean, with a name like Glendale, it doesn't have a name like Riverview, Mountain Crossing,
Woodlands.
Woodlands. Just Glendale. It reminds me of something we would have here. Not scenic.
This infuriated families of the patients, and they ended up protesting as well. Glendale was not close by, and families would not be able to see their loved ones as often. Nonetheless, the doors shut, and after the closure, the property changed faces yet again and was briefly a detention center for young offenders, according to an article from the Vancouver Sun. Plans were eventually made to demolish the building. However, in September of 1991, the Ministry of Land and Parks were offered a hefty sum of $8 million for the land. Giovanni Camporisi, an Italian developer and president of A&A Foods, would now own the land and all the buildings. His goal was to turn the area into a destination site for tourists, complete with lodging, a marina, a golf course, and commercial space. He would have to level some of the buildings on the property. Fortunately, the British Columbia government stepped in and prevented his plans from becoming a reality. He was also dealing with a court case that was not related to this, so that also was an impeding factor to him continuing with the project. He was, however, able to leave his mark on the property in the form of painting some of the buildings with murals. One of the murals painted on a building was found to be one of the towers from a cathedral in Padova. Giovanni had renamed the site Padova, as he was from Padova in Italy. Fast forward to modern day, the area is now known as Tranquille Farm Fresh, which offers tunnel escape rooms and heritage tours. The escape room uses the murals on the buildings as a sort of clue for the game. The murals are still there today, as well as some of the original buildings used for the sanatorium. The heritage tours and escape rooms set up by the Tranquille Farm Fresh are meant to honor the history of the land before colonization, during the tuberculosis epidemic, and through the development project of Giovanni. Back in 2018, Tranquille Sanatorium was converted into a creepy escape room for Halloween called the Escape from Padova. The underground tunnels of the complex served as the perfect medium for the escape room, and centered right below the sanatorium. The experience lasted 1 hour and promised to dish out heart-pounding terror in the dark. I will talk more about these mysterious tunnels in the next little bit. Before the formation of Tranquille Farm Fresh, when the property was dormant, the mysterious grounds gained fame from American paranormal reality TV series called MTV's Fear. The show hosted an episode which launched the idea that the grounds of Tranquille were haunted by ghosts. According to the current manager of Tranquille, he emphasizes that it's not haunted by ghosts. Instead, he believes that true history creates the mystery.
That's a good catchphrase.
He talked about some of his experiences on the property, which I will read for you here. The manager and his colleague ended up walking through the underground tunnels, armed with flashlights. While walking through, he thought he saw a hanging body from one of the pipes.
That escalated quickly.
However, it turned out to be a dummy planted there by a previous visitor.
That took some effort.
That would terrify me. On another occasion, the manager and a different colleague heard strange sounds coming from within the tunnels. They found out that it was a coyote chasing bats. He stated, "We turned our tail and ran out. We didn't know if the animal was safe to go near or if it was rabid. If we hadn't seen the coyote, we may have thought the sounds were paranormal." Despite his experience on the matter, some locals who are superstitious believe restless spirits still walk the grounds.
Are you superstitious or just a little stitious?
Just a little stitious.
Okay.
They believe that patients who died and former care workers are responsible for the hauntings. It has gained so much popularity as a haunted location that people from all around the world have visited Tronqueal. It is even said to be one of Canada's most haunted locations. Historically speaking, Tronqueal Sanatorium has seen a great amount of death and emotion. Tuberculosis claimed many lives within the walls of Tronqueal. Underground tunnels, as I have been describing, run across the property and were typically used to transport dry goods, laundry, and various supplies. However, it was also believed that the hospital used the tunnels to transport bodies out to the cemetery that is located on the property.
Dry goods coming in, dead bodies coming out, just passing each other in the hallway, nothing to see here.
The staff believed that it would be better psychologically for patients still fighting the illness not to see bodies leaving the hospital and going to the cemetery on a daily basis. So they used the tunnels for secrecy and courtesy.
Makes sense.
Some visitors of the sanatorium, expecting a haunted experience, claim to leave with much more than they bargained for. Some have experienced disembodied voices, while others have reported seeing apparitions wandering the grounds. Some have even described seeing orbs hovering around doorways and in hallways of the buildings. Orbs of light can be seen in various photos from the property, and a misty formation has appeared in pictures, but is not observed by the naked eye.
Have you ever seen an orb?
Personally, for me, orbs are very easily explained away as dust particles. I don't know. All the ones that I've seen, it's very difficult, unless it's on like a TV show or something like that. But in like photos that people take, like your average person, it just looks like a speck of dust.
One time I was with somebody and I saw something like shooting across my periphery. I thought to myself, that's kind of weird. I just kept it to myself. It was still in my mind. So I'm like, hey man, did you see something? And he's like, did you see that weird thing like shooting across the side there? I'm like, yeah, you saw the same thing?
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah.
I feel like, yeah, a personal experience where it's just you seeing it is one thing. But then if somebody else sees the exact same thing, that just validates it so much more. One story that stands out of a patient tragically passing away is of someone named Margaret Schilling, who had gone missing on December 1st of 1978. Staff at the sanatorium were not able to locate her for over a month. But in January, her body was discovered in one of the wards that had been abandoned for a long time.
What?
An autopsy was conducted to determine the cause of death, and it was determined that she died of heart failure. What is more disturbing was that when she was found, she was completely naked, and her clothing was neatly folded next to her body.
This must have been a giant wing of the hospital for them not to smell any scent of rotting flesh.
The thing is that there are so many different buildings on this property. It's not confined to one singular building. It's like multiple buildings spread out, and they're all connected by these tunnels.
You think with a missing patient, though, you'd search every room pretty quickly.
I guess they didn't think to even look in the abandoned area, though.
Mistakes were made.
As if the story couldn't get any more strange, there exists a permanent stain left behind by her body. People have tried to clean the stain numerous times, but to no avail. It is said that her spirit has been seen staring down from a window of the room where her body was found. Other sightings of her include a woman seen trying to escape the building or wandering the building late at night. Other sightings on the property of alleged former patients can appear as full-bodied apparitions standing in empty wings of the sanatorium. The sounds of squeaking gurneys can be heard in the halls, as well as blood-curdling screams. One person claimed to have been chased off the property by a mist-like figure. These sightings are commonplace according to the believers in the area. Lights in the buildings will turn on and off on their own, and the feeling of sadness permeates from the walls of the sanatorium. Children crying can also be heard coming from the 8th floor of one of the buildings, which was a pediatric center. Another story tells of a crying woman seen on the 6th and 8th floors of a building. And when she is approached, she vanishes into thin air. Her cries can still be heard even though she has disappeared. It is also claimed that a nurse was murdered by a patient and her spirit has been seen in different rooms of the hospital.
It's a pretty large claim to make. Did it happen or not?
I'm glad you asked that. So in my research, I could not find any evidence that a murder occurred on the property. So I believe this to be more of a story to scare people than an actual fact. The final story I will cover here comes from Abandoned History Blog, who went to the property with the intention to visit the sanatorium after hours. They talked about wanting to explore the buildings further than their tour had taken them and were very interested in getting inside any of the buildings because the tunnels connected all the buildings. So if they got in one building, they could access the tunnel and get to pretty much anywhere else they wanted to. They were trying to find a way into one of the buildings, and it was extremely difficult as all the windows that could be potential access points were boarded up. Eventually, they found a very small window open on the second floor of one of the main buildings and made their way to it. They had to squeeze their way through the small window, barely managing to fit through. Fortunately, they made it through the window and ended up in a shower room that had a greenish color to it, was accompanied by peeling walls. The excitement that ran through them was short-lived as they heard what sounded like a deep grunt coming from one of the rooms off the main hallway. This was followed by the sound of heavy footsteps approaching them. They went silent and thought a property caretaker had caught them and was coming to kick them out. They were frozen in place and were too scared to get caught, so they just crouched down and waited in the green shower room. Noticing that nobody was coming to get them, one of them spoke up and said, "Hello?" As soon as the words exited their mouth, another grunt was heard, but it was louder this time. It was followed once again by footsteps, but this time they were walking away from their location. Tensions were at an all-time high, and suddenly they heard a door slam shut and the footsteps ceased. They waited until they didn't hear any more noise and ended up looking down the hallway. Nobody was there. And what's even more frightening is there were no footprints in the dust that had settled on the floor along the entire length of the hallway. At this time, they expressed regret as they did not have time to prepare any of their gear to catch any evidence of the paranormal. However, they continued to explore the buildings, but had the ominous feeling that somebody or something was following them. And they could also hear voices talking to each other. So whether you are a believer of the paranormal or a skeptic, the walls of the Tronquille Sanatorium are drenched in history. The ghosts of former patients and staff could haunt this location, or maybe Tronquille is haunted more so by the memories of an unfortunate past and all who have tragically passed away. I'll let you decide what you want to believe. And that is a short history on the Tronquille Sanatorium of British Columbia.
Thank you for the stories, Jarrett. It put me into a tranquil place until the very ending.
Yeah, it was very, very dark at the ending for sure. But that's, again, if you believe in that kind of thing.
Do you believe?
I don't know. I want to believe. But at the same time, I also don't want to see any proof, if that makes sense.
What if your belief is what creates it? Kind of like a poltergeist type activity.
I mean, that would make sense. But I think in this case, so an interesting part of the story for MTV's Fear that I heard. Allegedly, MTV paid kids off in the area with pizza to run around in the woods while they were filming on the location, pretending to be ghosts and make noises and stuff.
Now that you mention it, I can't remember the exact details, but I remember hearing like a bunch of sketchy stuff about this show, that the fact that they did like morally wrong things to like scare people, like it wouldn't pass today.
Oh, I have never heard of that. I didn't really know much about this besides just that episode specifically, but I couldn't even really find that much detail on that episode. So I found that also interesting as well.
Yeah, they would like psychologically like scar people and just be like, hey, it's just a TV show.
Oh, that's messed up.
But like, it's real trauma still. If you think it's real at the moment, like you should have a decompressing afterwards.
Yeah, actually, I don't know if you've heard of these things, but around Halloween, I mean, I think they're all year round, but they're like basically like haunted houses on steroids. Like you have to sign waivers and they do some pretty like messed up kind of simulation things, which I'm not going to get too much into, but it's like so real to the point where they will physically contact you and put you into an awful environment. And they have like safety words and stuff that you can say if you want to back out. But I forget, there's a lot of detail on this and we might cover an episode on this in the future.
We'll just go there and tell you.
Well, I don't think they're operational anymore because that's how bad they were. I think they broke a lot of ethics and they did not conform to rules and regulations and they went too far. And some people got hurt and some people are scarred for life from these places. All right. So what did you think of tonight's story?
An interesting history. I enjoyed the mental scenery in my head until all the bad stuff and the death.
Yeah. That just sounds like a lot of sanatoriums for the most part. They always start off with nice area, good intentions, and they end in a great tragedy and a lot of suffering.
But they did harvest some apparently very good food.
Yeah, actually. So now, like today, the property is used by, like I said before, Tronquil Farm Fresh. And they're cultivating like a bunch of farms and a bunch of food and local foods to sell off to people. And they're trying to kind of transform the area while also maintaining the history. So if you have any ideas for the show or want your story featured, please email us at strangeanduncided@gmail.com. So once again, thanks for listening.
And good night.